Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. In December 2013, animal rights lawyer Stephen Wise showed the world how an animal can transition from a thing without rights to a person with legal protections when he filed on behalf of four captive chimpanzees in New York State the first ever lawsuits demanding personhood rights for animals. The founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, Stephen Wise has spent decades fighting to ensure the well-being and humane treatment of all animals. His lawsuits and the movie Unlocking the Cage herald a monumental shift in our culture as the public and judicial system show increasing receptiveness to his impassioned arguments. If successful, Stephen Wise and his team could forever alter how animals in and out of captivity are regarded and treated. Stephen Wise joins me tonight to share some of the harrowing stories behind the headlines and explain why animals should be protected from abuse in all the same ways that humans are. Stephen Wise, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Stephen, you began your mission to gain rights for non-human animals in 1985. It's a long time ago. What prompted that decision? Have you always been interested in animal rights?
I got interested in animal protection issues actually in 1980 when I read a book by the philosopher Peter Singer, Animal Liberation, in which he talked about how we treated non-human animals, how badly we treated them, and how many were affected by our treatment. You know, billions of them. And I also realized when I was reading the book that there didn't appear to be any lawyers who were standing up for the interests of non-human animals. So that was in 1980. I then worked as a lawyer with the Animal Legal Defense Fund until 1985, and I became president. And over those 5 years, as we were beginning to bring lawsuits, I realized that there was a serious problem, that all non-human animals had always been and were still being treated as legal things, which meant that they lacked the capacity for any sort of rights at all. They were essentially, you know, the slaves of persons, and persons are, at least amongst persons, are human beings. And so I realized that the only way in which even the most fundamental interests of non-human animals would ever be protected would be if they were persons, which meant if they had the capacity for any legal rights. And so in 1985, I decided that's what I would spend really the rest of my life doing, is trying to get legal personhood for non-human animals. I realized that they had never had personhood, and for 2,000 years they had been legal things. And I also knew that many human beings had been legal things as well, and we had all slowly become legal persons. And at that point, I thought it would take about 30 years of preparation before we'd be able to file the first lawsuits that had some kind of a reasonable chance of success. And indeed, I was a little bit pessimistic. It only took 28 years, 2013 instead of 2015.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a commitment that you undertook then, knowing that it was going to take three decades to do this.
Yes, and I knew it would, because if you go back to 1985, there is no real animal rights movement. There, people don't think about animal rights. There are no law books. There's no one teaching any classes. There are no law review articles. There are no books. There are no organizations. So I realized that we're going to have to start teaching classes in law schools, which I began to do. And since then, I've taught at 7 law schools, including Harvard Law School and Stanford Law School. I realized that we'd have to write law review articles, and I've written 22 of them. Books, I've written 4 of them. We'd have to have an organization. The one I began was the Non-Human Rights Project. And we'd also have to wait for all the people working in this area to help make the world turn to a point where it would begin to become receptive to the kinds of arguments I wanted to make. So I knew it was going to take a long time and a lot of hard work, and it finally happened in 2013, and we were ready to go. And the world was ready to hear it.
To put this into context for me, how long is it since the courts have seen corporations as humans?
Well, the courts have viewed corporations as persons. Now, there's a difference between being a person and being human. So human is a taxonomic, a biological term. A person is simply a legal term of art that says it's any entity who has the capacity for any sort of a legal right. So, for example, in the last year, New Zealand has made a river, the Whanganui River, and two national parks persons. And so the river and the national parks, you know, have the same rights as you and I might have as persons. They can sue or be sued. There's certain things you can do to them, you can't do to them, certain things that the parks and the river can do to you. In India has made a mosque a person, a Hindu idol a person, the holy books of the Sikh religion a person. And of course, in Argentina now, as of November 2016, a chimpanzee named Cecilia has been made a non-human a person. So a person is a term of art, meaning that you have the capacity for legal right, as opposed to a thing, which means that you don't have the capacity for any kind of legal right. And being a human and being a person are not synonymous. So as you can see, there are many non-humans or even non-living entities who have been persons. And unfortunately, throughout history, there's even been many human beings who have not been persons, who have been things, slaves. Sometimes women or children. Yes.
Yeah. So if there is a precedent, you mentioned Cecilia, why not Tommy and Kiko and the other animals that you're representing?
Well, we have been filing lawsuits on behalf of those four chimpanzees in New York, and we also filed our first lawsuit on behalf of three elephants in the state of Connecticut, Minnie, Beulah, and Karen. And so we're beginning that fight there. And I the answer is there shouldn't be any reason that the way we litigate our cases is that before we go into a jurisdiction, we look to see what the values and principles are that constitute justice, as the judges themselves say it in their opinions. And we then form our legal arguments in the exact same terms. So we find that they value liberty and equality, autonomy, the idea that a being understands that he had that she's had a yesterday. She knows she's living today. She has a future that she can plan for, you know, that can be good or ill for her. And judges we've seen are very concerned in making sure that right now at least human beings who are autonomous beings are able to live their lives as they choose in an autonomous way. They care about equality. They care about a reasoned judicial decision-making. They don't like arbitrary decision-making. And so we frame our arguments in those ways. And we have won pieces of many lawsuits. We have not yet been able to put them all together. For example, we have gotten standing, I believe, six times. We were the first people in the world to claim that we were not being injured by the lawsuit. Somebody else was, the chimpanzees or the elephants. And we demanded that the court give us standing, the Non-Human Rights Project, to file on their behalf, even though they were the ones being injured and we weren't. That had never been done before, so we succeeded there. In 2015, we succeeded in, for the first time, having a judge actually issue a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of the chimpanzees named Hercules and Leo, who were being held captive at Stony Brook University and being used for research. And we forced Stony Brook University to come into court through that habeas corpus to be forced to justify why they thought that they could enslave a chimpanzee or, you know, keep them captive for any reasons. We have not yet, like Cecilia, been able to persuade a court to then order them released and sent to a sanctuary, but we feel that the courts are being pushed into a place where they have the choice of either following through and making their rulings adhere to the ideals of justice, of liberty and equality, reason, decision-making, autonomy that they normally use, or they can try to figure out some way of making all but only human beings persons and giving them rights. But the problem is that undermines their basic ideals of justice. And when you read some of the decisions of courts who have, there have been two of them, who simply dismissed our cases because they said only humans can have rights, and they don't say why only humans can have rights, it just simply announced that our clients are not humans, and therefore they can't have rights. We've seen that sort of thing over the last 200 or 300 years, and it's always very painful. When there was a time when black people wanted rights, and the court said, well, you're not white. Well, what did that have to do with black people not having rights? Or when women had sought rights in personhood, and the court said, you're not a man. And everyone understood that they aren't a man, but what does being a man have to do with being the only entity who can have rights? Gay people didn't have rights, and the court would say, you're gay, you're not heterosexual, you can't have certain rights. And they'd say, well, the fact, these are distinctions without differences. There's no, just because you're a man or you're white or you're heterosexual, that doesn't mean that if you're not white or you're female or you're not a man and you're not heterosexual, why shouldn't you have rights as well? And the fact that to date the courts have simply only dismissed our cases by using one sentence saying, I'm sorry, they're not humans, that's also a distinction without a difference. There's no rational reason, and there's no reason that harmonizes with their ideals of justice that would support such a decision. And so eventually the courts will begin to understand that in the United States and elsewhere, and then things are going to begin moving very quickly. But there's kind of a period of time in which you have to give the judges time to get used to the fact you're making these arguments and the fact that for 2,000 years no non-human ever has been a person. And so judges tend to be a conservative bunch, and they aren't about to say, oh, for the last 2,000 years we've been making a mistake. It's going to take them a while to get used to it, but we are extraordinarily persistent. Our legal arguments are actually extraordinarily good, and we bring in the facts about the non-human animals on whose behalf we sue, whether chimpanzees or orcas or elephants, and those facts are brought through affidavits of the greatest scientists who spent their whole lives studying these animals. We have 10 of them from Jane Goodall down. With respect to chimpanzees, and I think we have 6 of them involving people like Cynthia Moss or Joyce Poole, who are well known for spending decades studying cognitive ability development. So it's really just a matter of time and persistence, and we have plenty of both.
So out of court, if you meet any of these judges out of court, what is their attitude? Do they say something different than what they say in court? Would they like to be able to do this but feel they can't?
Well, we usually don't talk to judges about our cases out of court. it's kind of frowned on our ethics. But, however, in there, there's one judge who, the one who issued the writ of habeas corpus, she wrote a long and thoughtful opinion in which she agreed with virtually everything we said. And the only reason that she did not actually order the chimpanzees out of Stony Brook was because she said that she felt bound by a decision of a higher court in another part of the state of New York. We argued to her that she was not bound by that, but she felt she was. And so she said that basically her hands were tied. But she also talked about the fact that she thinks one day chimpanzees, will get rights, and that the world does change. And she specifically cited to the gay marriage cases in the United States, where within a relatively short time, 20 years, 10 or 20 years, we went from making a crime to be a gay person to having a constitutional right to be a gay married person. So she understood things change, and she basically and she also cited a decision by the former chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court, in which the judge said a lower court is bound by what the higher court says, even when they disagree with what that court said. And so she was clearly signaling that she disagreed personally. So we do see that there are judges out there who do, Yeah, and we also you also mentioned the HBO BBC4 film on
Yes,
Unlocking the
yes.
Cage by D.A. Penn Baker and Chris Hegedus that was first came out at the Sundance Film Festival in 2016, and we know that there are judges who go to that film, and we also know that sometimes the judges talk to other people who then come back and talk to us, and that they are the ones who see the film like what they see, and they I think are eventually going to start ruling in our favor, which shouldn't surprise anybody because as I said, the arguments we make are the arguments are based upon what they consider to be justice, the values and principles that they hold most dear. If they really hold those most dear, they're going to have to start applying them to more than just human beings.
You know, 30 plus years, I mean, that's a very long time. And it's one thing to set out in the beginning knowing that it's going to take you that long, you know, but it's a hard slog. What kept you going?
What kept me going was the knowledge that there are billions and billions of non-human animals who are being terribly exploited, who are being killed, or who are being brutalized in ways that are almost impossible, you know, for us to imagine. And so I really understand that, and sometimes I've gone out and seen that. And I also know as a historian, and I'm a kind of a quasi-historian, one of the four books I wrote was actually the history of the Somerset case, which was a 1772 London case in which slavery ended through in England through the decision of Lord Mansfield, who was Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench. And so I understand how social change works, and I understand how slavery ended, how women got rights, and how children got rights. I spent years and years reading about these things, and I realized that they start with people like me, people who decided something is wrong, something has to change, and I'm going to, you know, pour my life's energies into being, if I have to be, the first person who is going to make that change, because every change requires someone to begin making that change. And I talked about that a little bit in the film about how hard it was, and said, "Well, the time has come to begin. Let's begin." And that's what we've been doing. Beginning, and I understood that that's what we were doing, and there was a certain goal that I had in mind, which is to get legal rights for non-human animals, and they need them. And I'm a lawyer. Why else am I a lawyer? What else could I be doing with my
Absolutely.
legal skills that would be, you know, that much more important?
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest is Stephen Wise, founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, the only civil rights organization in the USA working to secure legally recognized fundamental rights for non-human animals. We'll be back with more from Stephen Wise after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Change and growth are part of natural life and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephen Wise, can you explain to me why recognition of non-human rights is the best and most lasting way to change non-human animals' lives for the better? What will change when you get that?
Well, you know, it's hard to generalize. There are a million species of animals. I guess you and I are one of them. There's a million others. And they are extraordinarily diverse. There may be some non-human animals, you know, who are never going to get rights. I doubt beetles will get rights or crickets will get rights, but at least not for hundreds and hundreds of years. I don't even know what kind of arguments could be used for them. But there are many non-human animals who should have legal rights of some kind, like right now. For example, those beings who are autonomous, and we can prove it. All four species of great apes, three species of elephants, orcas, perhaps African great parrots, and others we haven't researched. They are autonomous beings. They can choose how to live their lives, and they live very complex emotional, cognitive, and social lives. And so, gaining them the right to bodily liberty that we argue they should have, and that a writ of habeas corpus protects, they should be immediately released from captivity. They should never be held in captivity. And they should either be sent back into the wild, or if they can't, they should be sent to a proper sanctuary where they can live as autonomous a life as possible. And if you have a right to bodily liberty, then you should not be captured in the first place. I would also argue there are many non-human animals who should have a right to bodily integrity. You shouldn't be able to do what if to a human being would be considered to be a battery, an unconsented to touching. You can't kill them, stab them, shoot them. You basically have to leave them alone. Those rights would be very important, for wild animals. There may be other kinds of rights that would be most appropriate for animals that we have domesticated. If you think of cats or dogs, especially. Who have become part of our family, and they may have certain kinds of rights because we have domesticated them and basically turned them into beings who both rely upon us and are in important ways, parts of our family and parts of our society. They may have different kinds of rights. So there's a lot to do if you consider that just based on one species, human beings. How many thousands of lawsuits are brought every year, and how many decades of litigation around the extent of rights for human beings? You can imagine how complex it would be to talk about the different kinds of rights that might be appropriate for a wide variety of non-human animals. So it all depends.
Can you tell us a little bit about Tommy and Kiko? They're two of the chimpanzees that you filed for. Tell us a little bit about their stories, their histories. I think it's really important for people to know what kind of lives they've led.
Indeed. Well, let's start with Tommy. I met Tommy. He was in a cage in a room in a warehouse, really like structure, on a piece of land in rural New York, in which they were. In which people were selling used trailers. And he was by himself. He lived by himself. To have a chimpanzee be forced to live by himself, which is essentially being in solitary confinement, has an effect upon that chimpanzee the way it would be if you and I were forced to live by ourselves in a cage in solitary confinement. We are extremely social creatures, as are chimpanzees. I've had the opportunity to spend some time with wild chimpanzees up in the Kibale Mountains in Uganda, and it's easy to see, how they live in what are called fission-fusion societies. in which they have family units. They might have 10 of them or 20 of them or 30 of them in one place, and they live in a community just like you and I would. And so a chimpanzee, who lives by himself, or sometimes people say one chimpanzee is no chimpanzee. It's just like one human being, forced into solitary. It's really no human being. We are turned into something that it's unnatural for us to be. So that's Tommy. Kiko was also living in a cage and in a storefront in Niagara Falls. And Kiko actually had another chimpanzee with him, and we were going to file a lawsuit on his behalf as well. But he died before we were able to even file our first lawsuit. So he also is living, he's the only chimpanzee. There are other non-human primates around. There are some monkeys around. They're living in their cages. But Kiko does as well. Kiko also is partially deaf. Kiko was used in movies. And when Kiko didn't do what she was supposed to do, she was beaten on the head so badly that she's partially deaf. People who go to see films in which there are apes, whether they're chimpanzees or gorillas or orangutans, don't for a second think that those animals are doing what they're doing because they want to. They're being terrorized into it. They're being forced into it. Same thing with almost every kind of wild animal who's being forced to do something, say in a film or in a circus. Those animals have been terrorized and beaten into submission. And so part of the effects of Kiko being beaten into submission is now Kiko remains partially deaf. So as you might imagine, neither Kiko nor Tommy have had any kind of a life that is fit, for a chimpanzee.
And likewise, your new elephant clients. Last night I went to the movies and I watched Showmen. It was about Barnum. And yes. I was thinking about, you and what the non-human rights are doing. And when I saw the ending, and they've got elephants, and Hugh Jackman was riding the back of an elephant, it really brought it home to me. Did they understand what they were doing when they were making that film? How well were those animals treated?
Well, we know how well those animals are treated. As I said, wild elephants will not don't tolerate that kind of behavior. And that's not how wild elephants live. You can understand what they tolerate by simply getting some kind of an idea as to how they live their lives. And for elephants, certainly, an autonomous being, who's forced into that sort of a situation, you can imagine what was done to those beings in order to make them do that sort of thing. Showmen is a disgrace, and the fact that in 2018 people would have a film in which you were exploiting non-human animals that way. It is a disgrace. It's rather depressing. It also took Barnum, who it made him seem like he was some kind of a wonderful guy, but he wasn't, yes. and he was yes. very involved in the abuse of animals, and the abuse of animals kept going on until just last year. The Barnum and Bailey Circus just went out of business in 2017. So he left a long and terrible legacy.
Yes, yes. And, when one remembers the outcry when somebody, was it Cedric the Lion, shot that
yes.
lion? I mean, it is all the more appalling to see a movie like that. It's one thing to have humans, people in the movie who agree to do it, but to see an elephant, that really did spoil it for me.
Well, it should spoil it for everyone. It's kind of an ugly thing to see. Hugh Jackman shouldn't have been involved in it. They shouldn't have made the film. And all I hope is that very few people see it, and then it goes, to to its well-deserved obscurity.
Yes.
And that people realize that, and they don't make those shows kinds of movies again. I was really kind of shocked that it would be made. I thought perhaps there had been more of a of an ethical, you know, advance in the film industry than this movie reveals.
Yeah, well, and it's not obvious. It certainly wasn't obvious from the trailers. But tell me about Beulah, Karen, Minnie, and a little bit about their stories.
Yes, two of them were actually captured from the wild in the 1980s. So they've actually known a life of living free. And since then, for decades now, they have lived at the Comerford Zoo in Connecticut, in a small town in Connecticut, and they're basically a part of a traveling circus. The elephants are put into trucks, and they go trucked all over northeastern parts of the United States. And they go to fairs, and I actually went to see them as part of our investigation as to whether we were going to file a lawsuit on their behalf. I actually went to see them once, or at least two of them, or one of them actually. And what I saw just so enraged me. In fact, if you see the film Unlocking the Cage, the very last scene is actually a film of me watching them and photographing them. And what I saw was them having to stay indoors the entire day, and people are just sit on their back and they pay to have the elephants just walk around in circles hour after hour after hour. And that's their lives. They walk around in circles, for weeks, for months, you know, for years, for decades. They're trucked around. It's a horrible, horrible life for an elephant. I don't know whether those people know anything about elephants, I've been to Kenya as well. I've been to the Amboseli Park, and I spent some time, studying elephants there. So I've seen elephants in the wild the way I've seen chimpanzees in the wild, and I've also read about them to a large degree and spent many hours speaking to experts about them. And I have a pretty good idea as to who they are in the wild. And they are these extraordinarily cognitively complex, socially complex, beings who are autonomous, and to enslave them in that way and, doom them to just being trucked around and walking around in circles with people sitting on their back is terrible. And we are going to do the best we can to free them, from their enslavement. And that's what they are. They're slaves. And we're doing the best we can to win a habeas corpus, to have them freed. And there's a wonderful elephant sanctuary called PAWS, or the Performing Animal Welfare Society, near Sacramento, California. And they have agreed to take those three elephants and allow them to live the rest of their lives, with other elephants on many, many acres of land in California, where the most important thing is these autonomous beings will be able to live an autonomous life, a life in which they can choose who their friends are going to be, what they're going to do, where they're going to be, just like you and I would want to do. And you can't minimize how much elephants or how much chimpanzees are like you and I in the most fundamental way.
Unlocking the Cage was first premiered in 2016 at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's been shown on HBO, it's on Apple iTunes and Netflix, etc.
BBC4 as well. It's on BBC4. They play it. I don't know how often they play it, but I know they play it every maybe 6 months now, because I get emails from people that said, I just saw it on BBC4. So we know it's been there. BBC4 was also one of the funders of the film.
Well, that's wonderful. I was going to ask you, what has the reaction been to that movie?
It's been extraordinary. First of all, the filmmakers, Chris Hedges and Dia Pennybaker, are perhaps the two greatest living documentary filmmakers. Dia Pennybaker is now 93 years old. He's one of the inventors, the creators of cinema verite, and he is the only documentary filmmaker to win an Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement. So he's an extraordinary filmmaker, and his wife and fellow filmmaker, Chris Hedges, has been with him for probably 30, 40 years. She's also an extraordinary filmmaker. They're both Academy Award nominees for documentary films they've done. So first of all, we knew that we were in the hands of master filmmakers. And then they did a masterful job. They did an excellent job in capturing what we were trying to do, how we were doing it. The New York Times, the LA Times, other places who reviewed them said that they had created a legal thriller. And I think they did. And I've seen it many times now. They have created a legal thriller. And then that explains, who we are, why we're doing such a thing, who our clients are, and people respond to it really in extraordinary way. I had no idea, what the reaction would be, and actually the first time I ever saw the film was at Sundance at a showing with 800 people, and when the film ended, to my astonishment, 800 people stood up and gave us a standing ovation. I was amazed, and then they did it again and again. I think we stitched 35 or 6 times at Sundance, and people kept giving us standing ovations. And now, wherever I go around the world, people not only show it on television stations like RTÉ in England and Germany and France and BBC4 and HBO, but we show it at conferences, in theaters, and people come out really being moved by it, and really having a fairly sophisticated understanding as to what it is we do, what the non-human rights project does, why we do it, who we are. And so across the world, in fact, I was just at a showing of it in Kathmandu, Nepal, just 3-4 weeks ago. And before that, I was in Helsinki a month before that. All over the world, people really, really are moved by it and are determined to join our work and do what they can to gain legal personhood and fundamental legal rights for non-human animals as well.
That must be an enormously gratifying thing after so long. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with animal rights lawyer, author, and founder and president of the Non-Human Rights Project, Stephen Wise, who spent decades fighting to ensure the well-being and humane treatment of all animals. We'll be back with more from Stephen Wise after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephen Wise, you founded the Non-Human Rights Project in 1996. We know what you stand for. We know what your goals and your mission is. Tell us how the Non-Human Rights Project works.
The Non-Human Rights Project has a core of lawyers. The purpose of our legal working group is to try to figure out where we should file suit, on whose behalf, which species of non-human animals, what sort of causes of action should we bring, how do we learn about what sort of cognition the non-human animals have, and then as we move from state to state within the United States, which is different from the UK, every single state has its own common law, as opposed to the UK, where there's really one uniform common law. So I have to, we all have to begin to learn the law of a new state every time we move from state to state. And then we're determined to turn out, you know, the highest quality of legal work that we possibly can. So we might work for a year or two or 3 years, you know, on a case before we ever file suit. So that's the core. We also have, we're also beginning to work at a campaigns level as well, so that we're integrating campaign department who will be working outside of the courtroom in the states in which we're working inside the courtroom. And these people are also going to begin the process of trying to get legal rights and personhood outside of the courtroom, for example, at the municipal level, from city to city or town to town in those states that might allow it. We have a wonderful communications director who just keeps the world and our donors and our members, you know, informed as to what we're doing, you know, asking them how we're doing, asking them if we can be of any help to them, and telling them how they might be able to be of help for us. And we have a wonderful public relations firm that sends out messages as to you know what it is we're doing. So we focus our litigation and our legislation now within the United States. But over the last 4 years, we've realized that the problem that we're dealing with is the constant exploitation of non-human animals as legal things. Certainly is not something that's confined just to the United States. We began to work with legal groups in other countries. And I think we're working now with legal groups in 15 countries, including folks in London, but also in Sweden and Finland and, you know, Spain and Portugal and Argentina, Australia and India, all over the world. We meet with them. I usually fly out and meet with them, and then other people take over, in which we're trying to offer whatever help we may be able to offer them for them to achieve the same goals in their countries, whether that's through the court system or through their parliaments or through both. So we're pretty busy.
How are you funded?
We are funded. We are in the United States, a 501c3 charitable organization. So we are funded entirely by donations, either through foundations or through individuals.
And I would imagine that Unlocking the Cage has helped, you know, really educate the public, and that you know, people are donating more to this.
Yes, we have found that Unlocking the Cage is a wonderful calling card for us, Kenya, so that people can see who we are. Sometimes people think that animal rights folks must be inherently crazy in some way, and they can see that we are, you know, very, very serious, well-prepared lawyers, which whatever the opposite of crazy is, that's us, and they can see how effective we are. So that has been really helpful. There's also a great deal of press. We're often covered in the London newspapers, in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other places, you know, throughout the world. And we had a few years ago, and we were the cover story for the Sunday New York Times magazine, I think in April of 2014, long article, about 6,000 or 7,000 words that talked about how we had come to the point of filing our first lawsuits. And it was a terrific introduction into who we were and how we work. And so we find that the more that our problem really is persuading people, our problem is having people know that we exist and what we do. And so the folks who write about us, you know, they're on a wonderful show like yours, that helps introduce our work to people. And we find that there's a lot of people out there who are sympathetic to what we do, and they understand that traditional animal welfare or traditional animal protection activities, you know, have their limits. You know, and actually they began in England almost exactly 200 years ago in 1821, And we haven't made that much progress because of the limitations of non-human animals being legal things who lack all capacity for rights. And all human history tells us that the only way that anyone, any entity's fundamental interests are ever going to be protected is if they have legal rights. And then an entity like you and I, who have legal rights and legal protections, you know, that is the optimum way in which that entity can flourish. And that's why we humans can flourish so well. And that's why we humans are no longer trucked around like the elephants are, kept in cages like chimpanzees are, because once there were millions and millions of humans who were treated in similar ways. And the reason that they're no longer treated that way is that they have fundamental rights. And the lesson for human beings is the same lesson for non-human beings.
You must have felt appalled by the latest actions of the Trump administration to lift the ban on importing elephant trophies from Africa. Tell us what that means in real terms.
Well, I think I can't really tell where we are on that. I think first they lifted the ban, and then I think there's been at least a temporary reinstatement of the ban while the Trump administration reevaluates it. But the Trump administration at the federal level has done all sorts of things that simply reverse protections for non-human animals that the Obama administration had given. Like, for example, you're allowed to shoot hibernating bears where you weren't allowed to do it during the Obama administration. And it's actually something that we point out to people when we're trying to explain why we are unique and why what we're doing is so important. I think the Trump administration has really demonstrated that for us, that when there are just simply protections or regulations that protect non-human animals, well, someone else can come in later on and just reverse them, as the Trump administration is doing. However, when there are rights, it's a lot harder to reverse those, and as the Trump administration's finding that out as well, that they don't have too many problems making it easier to exploit and kill non-human animals, but they're having a real problem when they try to impinge upon legal rights, and the courts are stepping in and saying, no way, we're not letting you do that. And that's what we point out. You know, for human beings, rights are extraordinarily important. Protections are not enough all by themselves. And the exact same thing is true for non-human beings, that it's rights that protect your fundamental interests, and just for non-human beings, the way they are for human beings.
Now, the Non-Human Rights Project is helping organizations, student clubs, and communities host public screenings of Unblocking the Cage. You're helping them with free one-time licenses for public screenings, helping draw in supporters in local areas to attend the screening, and you provided a citizen action toolkit on your website as well. What
Yes.
other ways can the public help you?
The public can help us by doing things like showing the film at film parties. Although we are the stars and the subjects of Unlocking the Cage, we don't own it, and when we show it, we have to pay for licenses as well. So we have purchased probably 100 or 200 licenses, and we do then allow people to show them for free after we've paid those. In the United States, and I'm not exactly sure this works now outside the United States, but if someone texts the word UNLOCK, 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 to 52886, then assuming it works outside the United States, then something will pop up, and we will then start asking you questions, and we'll get you in our database, and we'll be talking to you about how you might support us, depending upon where you are.
And you've also started a Rumble for Rights for Elephants program. Tell us a little bit about that.
That is the brainchild of Lauren Choplin, who is our wonderful communications director in Los Angeles. And she is setting out ways in which someone can specifically work with us to help make people aware of how the elephants in Africa are being treated, how elephants generally are being treated, why how often should have legal rights and how they might be able to assist us in Connecticut. It's a hashtag Rumble for Rights. And also just the very idea that there is a hashtag Rumble for Rights, again, Lauren's idea, brings the awareness to people that that there is a problem and that the Non-Human Rights Project is doing what it can to get rights for these elephants in Connecticut. And we hope, you know, after Connecticut, elephants are elsewhere as well.
And presumably people can also donate, which is another way to support you.
Absolutely. We love when people donate. And if you go to our website, which is nonhumanrights.org, we have a donate button. We also have a great website. We spent a lot of time, put a lot of energy into having a very accessible, interesting website. And I find that when I meet people all over the world, people compliment us on our, how good the website is. And part of that is you can donate to us, and we will, you know, try to keep you as hyper informed about the activities of the Non-Human Rights Project as we can. And see what we might be able to match your interests and skills with what needs to be done in harmony with our legal work.
And it's great that you have the Citizen Action Toolkits, because you're making it so easy for people to be able to support you.
Yes, it's, you know, it's not rocket science. There are certain known ways of being able to change the world. You know, and one of them is through litigation, and others are through politics. We try to work with people so they can help raise people's consciousnesses and help them figure out what they might be able to do for us. I guess that it's all under the rubric of it's politics.
When you first started out, it said that people used to bark at you in the courtroom, presumably colleagues, members of the public, I don't know. That must have been really dispiriting at that time. What happens when you enter a courtroom now?
We're treated with an enormous amount of respect now. The difference in the last 30 years is just extraordinary. Because if you bring yourself back to 1980, when I started this, nobody ever thought about what we do. No one ever heard really of even the idea of animal rights or animal protection was this thing that maybe RSPCA would do, or the Humane Society did in the United States, and had been doing for 100 years. The idea of lawyers coming in and demanding that courts protect non-human animals was just something that no one had ever thought about. Now that has changed. As I said, I've written 4 books. I've done book tours. I've written 22 law review articles. If someone wants to make fun of me, I say, well, have you ever taught at Harvard Law School? Have you ever taught at Stanford Law School? Well, I have. People understand that Harvard or Stanford are not going to allow people who have no idea what they're talking about to go in and teach. I taught at Vermont Law School for 25 years. And Lewis and Clark, I've been teaching there for 12 years. And also, have had literally thousands of students take my classes, and who then go out and into the world, and they do animal protection law, or some of them even come back to work with the Non-Human Rights Project, and they end up doing truly animal rights. And when I teach in Barcelona in the master's degree in animal law program at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, those students go out into the EU. Go out into Europe and begin, bringing that kind of knowledge to bear on the work of, in all kinds of departments, within Europe. There's just an enormous amount that's going on. And people, I never have to explain what I do anymore. At one point, I had to explain what I do. And now I find, if I'm sitting beside someone on an airplane, someone says, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a civil rights lawyer who fights for the legal rights of non-human animals. And I've never had a person just go back to reading their book or looking at the film and go, well, what are you telling me all about that? That sounds amazing. I tell them, it is amazing. The world is changing. We're making history, and we know it.
How far away do you think you are from winning?
Well, it depends how you how you define winning. It'd be like saying, well, how far are you from getting civil rights for humans? Well, there's always going to be, people are always going to be fighting for civil rights for humans. The question would be, maybe how far are we to getting the first, you know, winning the first cases within the United States? And you know, that can literally happen in, you know, any day. It's what will happen next month, will happen next year, it'll happen in 5 years. You know, we don't really know, but once it starts happening, then it's, the dam is going to burst. And the reason it's going to burst, again, is that our arguments are in harmony with how what judges say they believe in. When we ask a judge, what do you believe in? What is justice? And the judge tells us what justice is, and we know by his or her writings, the arguments that we're making for justice for non-human animals are the same ones for humans. And so eventually they're going to get it, and they're going to realize that by ruling against us, what they're actually undermining justice for humans as well. And again, when you look at the cases involving women who demanded rights, or blacks who demanded rights, or gays who demanded rights, they met a lot of opposition, you know, for quite some time, just the kind of opposition that we expect under meeting. But those days are changing, and once it begins to change, it's going to change very quickly.
Stephen Wise, on behalf of everybody who cares about animal welfare, non-human animal rights, thank you.
Well, thank you for a wonderful interview.
Thank you. For more information about how you can bring the movie Unlocking the Cage to your town, or raise awareness of the world's first elephant rights lawsuit, and support the work of the Non-Human Rights Project, visit www.nonhumanrights.org. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today. And if you'd like to be among the first to know about future guests and shows, you can sign up for my newsletter at sedgbeer.com. Meantime, I'll be back at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.